This is Audible.
Firewall by Andy McNab. Read by Paul Thornley. Chapter 1. Helsinki, Finland. Monday, 6th of December, 1999. The Russians were serious players. If things didn't go as planned, Sergei said, I'd be lucky to be shot dead in the hotel lobby. If they captured me, I'd be taken to a remote bit of wasteland and have my stomach slit open. They'd pull my intestines out and leave me to watch them squirm around on my chest like a bucket of freshly caught eels for the 30 minutes it would take me to die. These things happen, he had explained, when you mess with the main men in ROC, Russian Organized Crime. But I didn't have a choice. I desperately needed the cash. What's it called again, Sergei? I mimed a disembowelment. Eyes staring straight ahead, he gave a brief, somber smile and muttered, Viking's Revenge. It was just before 7 p.m., and it had already been dark for 3.5 hours. The air temperature had been well below freezing all day. It hadn't snowed for a while, but there was still a lot of the stuff about, ploughed to the sides of the roads. The two of us had been sitting very still for the best part of an hour. Until I'd just spoken, our breathing was the only sign of movement. We were parked 2 blocks away from the Intercontinental Hotel, using the shadows between the streetlights to conceal our presence in the dirty black Nissan 4x4. The rear seats were down flat to make it easier to bundle the target inside, complete with me wrapped round him like a wrestler to keep him there. The 4x4 was sterile. No prints, and completely empty apart from the trauma pack lying on the folded seats. Our boy had to be delivered across the border alive, and a couple of litres of Ringer's solution might come in handy if this job turned into a gangfuck. Right now, it certainly had all the ingredients of one. I found myself hoping it wouldn't be me needing the infusion. It had been a while since I'd felt the need to pre-cannulate, making it quicker for me to replace any fluid from gunshot wounds, but today had just that feel about it. I'd brought a catheter from the UK, and it was already inserted into a vein under my left forearm, secured by tape and protected by tubi grip. Anticoagulant was preloaded inside the catheter's needle and chamber to stop the blood that filled it from clotting. Ringer solution isn't as good as plasma to replace blood loss. It's only a saline mix. But I didn't want anything plasma-based. Russian quality control was a contradiction in terms, and money was what I wanted to return to the UK with, not HIV. I'd spent enough time in Africa not treating anyone's gunshot wounds because of the risk of infection, and I wasn't about to let it happen now. We sat facing Manahaminty, 200 metres down the hill from our position. The boulevard was the main drag into the city centre, just 15 minutes' walk away to the right. It carried a constant stream of slow, obedient traffic each side of the tram lines. Up here, it was like a different world. Low-level apartment blocks hugged each side of the quiet street, and an inverted V of white Christmas lights sparkled in almost every window. People walked past, straining under the weight of their shopping, crammed into large carrier bags with pictures of Holly and Santa. They didn't notice us as they headed home to their smart apartments. They were too busy keeping their footing on the icy pavements and their heads down against the wind that howled and buffeted the 4x4. The engine had been off all the time we'd been here, and it was like sitting in a fridge. Our breath billowed like low cloud as we waited. I kept visualizing how, when, and where I was going to do my stuff, and more importantly, what I was going to do if things got fucked up. Once the target has been selected, the basic sequence of a kidnap is nearly always the same. First comes reconnaissance, second, abduction, third, detention, fourth, negotiation, fifth, ransom payment, and finally, release. Though sometimes that doesn't happen. My job was to plan and implement the first 3 phases. The rest of the task was out of my hands. Three members of the Loud Tie and Braces Brigade from a private bank had approached me in London. They'd been given my name by an ex-regiment mate who now worked for one of the big security companies, and who'd been nice enough to recommend me when this particular commission had been declined. Britain, they said to me as we sat at a window table in the roof bar of the Hilton, looking down onto the gardens of Buckingham Palace, is facing an explosion in Russian mafia-organized crime. London is a money-laundering haven. The ROC are moving as much as £20 billion through the city each year, and up to 200 of their senior players either live in Britain or visit regularly. The executives went on to say they'd discovered that millions had been channeled through Valentin Lebed's accounts at their bank in just 3 years. They didn't like that, and were none too keen on the thought of the boys with the blue flashing lights paying him a visit and seeing the name on all his paying in slips. Their solution was to have Val lifted and taken to St. Petersburg, where, I presumed, they had either made arrangements to persuade him to move his account to a different bank, or to channel even more through them to make the risk more acceptable. Whichever, I didn't give a fuck, so long as I got paid. I looked over at Sergei. His eyes glinted as he stared at the traffic below us, and his Adam's apple moved as he swallowed. There wasn't anything left to say. We'd done enough talking during the 2-week build-up. It was now time to do. The conference of European Council members was due to start in Helsinki in 2 days. Blue EU flags already lined the main roads, and large black convoys of Eurocrats drove around with motorcycle outriders, heading from pre-meeting to pre-meeting. The police had set up diversions to control the flow of traffic around the city, and orange reflective cones and barriers were springing up everywhere. I'd already had to change our escape route twice because of it. Like all the high-class hotels, the Intercontinental was housing the Exodus from Brussels. All the suits had been in the city since last week, wheeling and dealing, so that when the heads of state hit town, all they'd have to do was politely refuse Tony Blair's invitation to eat British beef at some dinner for the media, then leave. All very good. But for me, security around here was tighter than a duck's arse. Everything from sealed manholes to prevent bombs being planted to a heavy police presence on the streets. They would certainly have contingency plans for every possible event, especially armed attack. Sergei had a folding stock AK, a Russian automatic 7.62mm short assault rifle, under his feet. His cropped, thinning brown hair was covered by a dark blue woolen hat, and the old Soviet army body armor he wore under his duvet jacket made him look like the Michelin man. If Hollywood was looking for a Russian hardhead, Sergei would win the screen test every time. Late 40s, square jaw, high cheekbones and blue eyes that didn't just pierce, they chopped you into tiny pieces. The only reason he would never be a leading man was his badly pockmarked skin. Either he'd steered away from the Clearasil in his youth, or he'd been burned. I couldn't tell. And I didn't want to ask. He was a hard, reliable man. And one I felt it was okay to do business with. But he wasn't going to be on my Christmas card list. I had read about Sergei Lysenkov's freelance activities in intelligence service reports. He had been a member of Spetsnaz's Alpha Group, an elite of special forces officers within the KGB, who used to be deployed wherever Moscow's power was under threat or there were wars of expansion. When hardline heads of the KGB led the 1991 coup in Moscow, they ordered Alpha Group to kill Yeltsin as he held out in the Russian White House. But Sergei and his mates decided that enough was enough and that the politicos were all as bad as each other. They disobeyed the order. The coup failed, and when Yeltsin learned what had nearly happened, he took them under his direct command. Cutting their power by turning them into his own bodyguards, Sergei decided to quit and make his experience and knowledge available to the highest bidder. And today, that was me. It had been easy enough to make contact. I just went to Moscow and asked a few security companies where I could find him. I needed Russians on the team because I needed to know how Russians think, how Russians do, And when I discovered that Valentin Lebed would be in Helsinki for 24 hours of R&R, and not in his fortress in St. Petersburg, Sergei was the only one who could organize vehicles, weapons, and the bribing of border guards in the time available. The people who'd briefed me on the job had done their homework well. Valentin Lebed, they were able to tell me, had been smart during the fall of communism. Unlike some of his gaucher colleagues, he didn't keep the designer labels on the sleeves of his new suit to show how much it had cost. His rise was brutal and meteoric. Within 2 years, he was one of the dozen heads of the mafiocracy who had made ROC so powerful around the world. Lebed's firm employed only ex-KGB agents overseas, using their skills and experience to run international crime like a military operation. Coming from dirt-poor beginnings as a farmer's son in Chechnya, he'd fought against the Russians in the mid-90s war. His fame was sealed after rallying his men by making them watch Braveheart time and time again as the Russians bombed them day after day. He even painted his face half blue when attacking. After the war, he'd had other ideas, all of them involving US dollars, and the place he'd chosen to realize them was St. Petersburg. Much of his money came from arms dealing, extortion, and a string of nightclubs he owned in Moscow and elsewhere, which served as fronts for prostitution rackets. Jewelry businesses he had acquired in Eastern Europe were used as a front to fence icons stolen from churches and museums. He also had bases in the United States, and was said to have brokered a deal to dump hundreds of tons of American toxic waste on his motherland. In the Far East, he'd even bought an airline, just so he could ship out heroin without administrative hassle. Within just a few years, according to the guys who'd briefed me, such activities were said to have netted him more than $200 million. 3 blocks the other side of the hotel, parked in a car that would be abandoned once this lift kicked off, were two more of the 6-man team. Carpenter and Nightmare were armed with 9mm mini Uzi machine guns, a very small version of the Uzi 9mm on harnesses under their overcoats, the same as the BG, bodyguards, we were going up against. They were good, reliable weapons, if a little heavy for their size. It was ironic, but Sergei had obtained the team's Uzis and old Spanish semi-automatic suppressed 7mm pistols from one of Valentin's own dealers. Carpenter and Nightmare weren't their real names, of course. Sergei, the only one who spoke English, had told me that was how they translated. And that was how he referred to them, just as well, as I couldn't have pronounced them in Russian anyway. Nightmare was living up to his name. He certainly wasn't the sharpest tool in Sergei's shed. Things needed to be demonstrated 20 or 30 times before he got the idea. There was a slight flatness to his face that, together with his constantly shifting eyes and the fact that he didn't seem too good at keeping food in his mouth, made him look a bit scary. Carpenter had a heroin habit that Sergei assured me would not affect his performance, but it certainly had during the build-up. He had lips that were constantly at work, as though he'd swallowed something and was trying to recapture the taste. Sergei told him that if he screwed up on the ground, he would personally kill him. Nightmare was like a big brother to Carpenter, and protected him when Sergei gripped him for messing up. But it seemed to me that Nightmare would be lost without him, that they needed each other. Sergei told me they'd been friends since they were teenagers. Nightmare's family had looked after Carpenter when his mother went down for life for killing her husband. She'd discovered he'd raped his own 17-year-old daughter. As if that wasn't enough, Sergei was his uncle, his father's brother. It was EastEnders Russian style, and the only thing I liked about it was that it made my own family seem normal. Carpenter and Nightmare would be in the hotel with me for the lift. Perhaps I could keep some control over them if I had them with me. The last two on the team I'd christened the Cray Twins, and they were in a green Toyota 4x4. I wasn't so worried about them. Unlike the other two, they didn't have to be told what to do more than twice. They had the trigger on the target's three black Mercedes, which were about 2 km away from the hotel. They also had folding stock AKs and AP, armour-piercing rounds in their mags. And, like Sergei, they wore enough body armour to cripple a small horse. The target was well protected in the hotel, and his vehicles were securely parked underground so that no device, explosive, from his enemies, or listening or surveillance from law enforcement, could be placed. When they finally moved out to pick him up from the hotel with the rest of his BG, the craze would follow. Carpenter and Nightmare would then take up the positions in the hotel along with me. Sergei, Reggie and Ronnie would take on the vehicles. The craze were both ex-Alpha Group 2, but unlike Sergei, they were far too good-looking to be straight. They'd been together since their time as young conscripts in Afghanistan, leaving after the previous Chechen War in the mid-90s, disillusioned with the leadership that had let them lose against the rebels. Both were in their mid-30s with dyed blonde hair, very clean-shaven and well-groomed. If they'd wanted a change of career, they could have become catalogue models. They had never been parted during their military career. As far as I could make out, all they wanted to do was kill Chechen rebels and swap admiring glances. I knew I could trust Sergei, but I still wondered about his selection procedure. He obviously wanted to keep most of the wad I'd promised him and had decided not to bring the A-team. It was the most unprofessional job I'd ever been on, and I'd been on a few. Things had got so bad that I'd even taken to sleeping with my door barred and my weapon ready. If the team weren't complaining to him about my planning, Sergei said, they were moaning about who was earning what and how they might get ripped off when it came to payday. Carpenter was so homophobic he made Hitler look like a wet liberal, and it had taken as much effort keeping the two pairs away from each other as it had preparing for the job. I did my best to keep out of their way, and concentrated on dealing exclusively with Sergei. He was the one I had to keep happy, because he was the only one who could help me get the target into Russia. But they got me flapping. People were going to die today, and I didn't want to be one of them. I was with a scary crew against a scary target. With the whole of Western Europe's leadership due in town, bringing along enough security to take on China. This wasn't a good day out, but fuck it. Desperation makes people do desperate things. I blew out another cloud of breath. The digital display on the dash told me another 20 minutes had passed. Time for a radio check. Reaching into my inside jacket pocket, I felt for the send button on my very yellow Motorola handset, the sort that parents use to keep tabs on their kids on the ski slopes or in the shopping mall. All six of us had one, each connected to an earpiece which was hooked in place. With so many people using hands-free sets on their mobile phones, we wouldn't be conspicuous wandering around with them in. I pressed twice, the squelch sounding off in my ear, then checked with Sergei. He nodded. I was sending. Reggie and Ronnie replied with two squelches. Then Carpenter and Nightmare followed with three. If I'd hit the send button and there was nothing from the craze, Carpenter and Nightmare would have waited 30 seconds and replied anyway. We would have no option then but to close in on the target and wait for the mercs to arrive. Not good, as it exposed us three in the hotel and messed up coordination. There was radio silence for two reasons. One, I couldn't speak the language, and two, EU land security would be listening in. With any luck, a few clicks here and there wouldn't mean a thing. There were many other standby comms I could have used, mobile phones for instance, but everything had to be kept pretty basic for Nightmare and Carpenter. Anything else to remember and they would have blown up. The old principle of planning, keep it simple, stupid, rang true yet again. While Sergei had gone for the Michelin man look, I was very much the businessman. Single-breasted suit, jacket one size up, dark grey overcoat, black woolen scarf and thin leather gloves, and the stress to match. Nightmare and Carpenter were dressed in the same style. All three of us were clean-shaven, hair washed and well-groomed. Detail counts. We had to move about the hotel without anyone giving us a second glance, looking as if we were part of the all-expenses-paid, outrageous salary Brussels gravy train. Across my lap, I even had today's edition of the Herald Tribune. My overcoat was doing a good job of concealing the body armour under my shirt. Sergei's might be as thick as the paving slabs outside the Kremlin, but mine consisted of just 12 paper-thin sheets of Kevlar. Not enough to stop one of Sergei's AP rounds, but enough to see off the mini Uzis that might soon be trying to hose me down. There was a pocket in the body armour for a ceramic plate to cover my chest area, but unlike Sergei, I couldn't wear one as it was far too bulky. Carpenter had refused to wear any at all because it wasn't manly. A nightmare had followed suit. Fucking mad. If I could have, I'd have covered myself from head to toe in this stuff. My feet were in all sorts of shit. With nothing on but thin socks and a pair of lace-up shoes, they were as cold as bags of frozen peas. I could no longer feel anything below my ankles, and had given up moving them around to generate heat. I was carrying a South African Z-88, which looked like a 9mm Beretta, the sort of pistol Mel Gibson uses in the Lethal Weapon films. When the world banned weapons exports to South Africa during apartheid, the boys just set about making their own gear, and were now exporting more assault weapons and helicopters than the UK. I had 3 20-round extended mags, which meant an extra 2 inches hanging out of the pistol grip, looking as if it had partially fallen out. The 2 spares went into my left-hand overcoat pocket. If things went to plan, I wouldn't even be drawing down. The lift should be, would be, silent, and take less than a minute. The body armour was the lightest I'd dared wear. But even so, it made it impossible to draw or sit down with a pistol placed where I would normally have had it. Centre front, tucked down the front of my jeans or trousers in an internal holster. I wasn't feeling happy about my new weapon position. Now it had to be on the right-hand side of my trouser belt. I'd had to spend the last 2 weeks practicing and consciously reminding myself that the position had changed. Otherwise, I might go to draw down on someone and find my hand hitting Kevlar instead of a pistol grip. That was if I could get to it through all the layers of clothing. To be able to flick back the top layers quickly, I'd taped together some sockets from the set in the car and carried them in the right-hand pockets of both my coat and jacket. It was just one more thing making me feel uneasy. My only consolation was that this time tomorrow, it would all be over. I'd get my money and never see these lunatics again. There was rustling as Sergei unwrapped a chocolate bar and started to throw it down his neck without offering me any. Not that I wanted it. I wasn't hungry, just worried. I sat there waiting, with the sound of Sergei's teeth mashing and jaws clicking as the wind whistled around the wagon. I sat and thought as he sucked his teeth clean. So far, Valentin had evaded the authorities, mainly because he had learned early on that it was good to have friends in powerful places and officials on the payroll. Key witnesses were routinely murdered before they could testify against him. Just a few months earlier, Sergei said, an American journalist who'd delved a bit too deeply into Val's business affairs was forced into hiding, with his family, after a phone call was intercepted in which Val was heard putting out a contract of $100,000, not just on the reporter's life, but also on those of his wife and child. It was for those who betrayed his trust, however, that the worst fate was reserved. 2 senior managers who oversaw his prostitution empire had been caught skimming a bit off the top at his Moscow brothels. Even though they'd fought alongside him in the Braveheart days and had been faithful lieutenants ever since, Val had had them taken out and staked to the earth on waste ground not far from Red Square, where he'd personally slit their bellies, pulled out their intestines, and waited patiently for them to die. The Viking's revenge appeared to have done the trick. Ever since then, not a single ruble had gone astray from any of his tills. I heard 6 quick squelches in my earpiece. The 3 pickup mercs were mobile towards the hotel. I replied with 2 squelches, then heard another two from Nightmare and Carpenter, who should now be getting out of their car and heading for the hotel. All six of us knew it was time to start performing. Sergei didn't say a word, just nodded. He might speak English, but it had to be squeezed out of him. I nodded back, checking my weapon was still in position. I got out of the 4x4 and left Sergei staring downhill. Pulling up my coat collar to protect me from the wind, I headed in the opposite direction, away from the main. My route took me up the hill for 30 meters, then a right turn to the next T-junction. That put me on the road adjacent to the hotel and down to the main drag again. I could see the large grey concrete hotel in front of me on the left-hand side of the road. Just short of it were roadworks, surrounded by steel fencing. The cobblestones were up, and the pipes were being repaired. I didn't envy the poor bastards who had to finish the job in this weather. The noise from the main grew louder as I walked downhill. The Kray twins would be on it now, following the mercs. Nightmare and Carpenter should be walking into the hotel from the opposite side, and Sergei would be positioning himself so that he'd be able to move in on the mercs at the front of the hotel. I crossed the road, passing the hotel's rear service and car park entrance. Two white Hilux delivery vans were parked up on the red asphalt. There was a glass door giving access to the hotel beyond the delivery bays, but you could only get through it by buzzing reception. And I didn't want to make myself any more conspicuous than I had to. Neither of the two loading bays was open. It was far too cold. I continued downhill, the hotel now obscured by a line of high conifers. Valentin Lebed's weakest point would be tonight, in Finland, in this hotel, before he left for the theatre. He was on his way to see Romeo and Juliet. The theatre was only across the road, a few hundred metres away to the left, but it was cold. He had always been a target for attack, and he was incredibly rich, so why walk? About 30 metres short of the main road, I hit the driveway from the Intercontinental's front entrance. It was a semicircle and one way. I turned left. In front of me, halfway down the concrete and glass building, was a large blue canopy to protect guests from the elements as they got in and out of their cars. The ground floor walls were glass, through which I could see the warm and cozy-looking interior. Small trees lined the driveway. They had lost their leaves and were now covered in white Christmas lights. The snow made them look as if they'd been sprinkled with icing sugar. I carried on past the illuminated reindeer that stood on the lawn between the driveway and main drag, which was about 30 meters down a gentle slope. The plan was simple. Nightmare and Carpenter were to kill the close BG that were protecting the target as he came from the lift, then cover me as I took the target towards the main doors. While this was happening, the Kray twins would have blocked off the rear of the mercs with their 4x4. Sergei would block the front with the Nissan, and all three would be controlling the other BG and drivers with their AKs. Once outside, I'd head for the back of the Nissan, dragging the target with me. We'd both lie under a blanket with my pistol rammed in his gob, while Sergei drove to the DOP, vehicle drop-off point, where the target would be switched to the boot of a changeover vehicle en route to the border. Meanwhile, Ronnie and Reggie would be giving the area the good news with CS gas before leaving in their Toyota, along with the other two, to their DOP and changing vehicles. We'd all RV near the border and get into a truck that was rigged up with hidden compartments while Sergei drove us into Mother Russia. Then it was just a few hours to St. Petersburg and payday. Nice work if you can get it. I walked under the canopy and through the first set of automatic tinted glass and brass effect doors. Once past the second set, I was in. My face flushed from the downward blast of the heaters above the doorway. I knew the foyer area well. It had the air of an expensive, comfortable club. I hadn't seen any of the rooms, but they must have been stunning. In front of me, about 30 meters away, and behind a group of very noisy and confused Japanese tourists surrounding a mountain of matching suitcases, was the reception desk. In the far right-hand corner was a corridor that led to the restaurant, toilets, and the all-important lifts. By now, Nightmare and Carpenter should be at the far end of the corridor, sitting by the restaurant entrance. From there, they could keep Trigger on the three lift doors. Immediately to my right, behind a dark, wood-panelled wall, was the Baltic Bar. To my left, efficient-looking bellboys were buzzing around a sprinkling of sofas, chairs and coffee tables. The lighting was subdued. I wished I'd just dropped in for a drink. I headed for one of the sofas, sitting down so that I was facing the Japanese confusion at reception to my half-right, with the corridor to the right of that and the brass effect lift doors in view. Like me, Nightmare and Carpenter had placed themselves out of sight of the video cameras that were covering the reception desk. I sat, spread out the trib on the coffee table, unbuttoned my overcoat and waited for the convoy of mercs to arrive. It was pointless worrying about anything now. There was only so much training and planning that can be done. I used to get worried when this feeling came over me, but now I understood it. Basically, I accepted that I was going to die, and anything beyond that was a bonus. Chapter 2. The Japanese weren't at all happy, and they didn't care who knew it. There must have been about 20 of them, all with video cameras round their necks. 3 minutes later, the headlights of the three mercs raked the ground floor windows. Reggie and Ronnie should have pulled up just short of the semicircular driveway where they'd be standing by. Sergei would be waiting to block their front. I waited for the inside set of sliding doors to open, keeping my head down, concentrating hard on my newspaper. In came the BG. 2 pairs of shiny Italian shoes and expensive black cashmere overcoats over black trousers. You always avoid eye contact, because they'll be looking for it. If your eyes lock, you're fucked. They'll know you aren't there to talk about the beef ban. I watched the 2 sets of heels make their way over to the far right of the foyer. They paused by the brass lift doors, now and again shielded by the Japanese as they went in pursuit of one very hassled hotel rep. The middle door slid open with a gentle ping. The shoes went in, and 2 more sets of shoes were refused entry. The doors closed, and the indicator light stopped at the ambassador suite. They were going to meet up with the other 2 BG who were already with Valentin, their principal, my target, my money. I got up, folding the trib into my coat pocket, and started to walk towards the main doors. As I moved past them, towards the leather-boothed, dark wood Baltic Bar, I could see 3 very clean black mercs on the other side of the glass, exhaust fumes condensing in the cold air, each with a driver waiting patiently at the wheel. The bar was half full and not very smoky, considering the number of cigarettes I could see on the go. There were quite a few laptops open, and there was a general hubbub as suits talked shop over a beer or into their mobiles. Unbuttoning my suit jacket as I walked, but keeping my overcoat on to conceal the body armor, I made my way around the tables and leather Chesterfields towards the far door. I seated myself where I could see down the corridor to the 3 lift doors, set back slightly in the right-hand wall. Beyond them, and just out of sight, were the reception and foyer. At the other end of the corridor, Carpenter and Nightmare should be in position in the coffee area of the restaurant, with a clear view all the way down to the foyer. Under the table, I pulled at my right glove and eased my index finger through the cut in the leather. 5 long minutes went by as lifts came and went, but Val still hadn't made an appearance. 2 middle-aged couples emerged from the center lift, dressed in furs and dinner jackets, looking as if they, too, were going to the theater. It was now that I started to worry. The calm was over and the storm was about to begin. My heart was pumping big time. My body armor was wet with sweat, and my shirt collar was soaking it up from the back of my neck. Any minute now, someone was going to ask me if I was ill. I was sure of it. Mentally, I was still the same, but my body was telling me something different. About 20 seconds later, there was another ping. The 2 pairs of expensive Italian shoes emerged from the right-hand lift and stopped in the corridor for a second or two, each pair facing in a different direction. The overcoat of the BG facing towards me swirled open as he turned, then both moved towards the foyer, disappearing from view as quickly as they'd arrived. I knew their jackets and overcoats would be like mine, open to access their weapons. I moved my hand into my inside jacket pocket and gave the Motorola 6 clicks on the send button, hearing the squelch in my earpiece each time. Val would be down any minute now. Sergei, Reggie and Ronnie would now know that the target and BG were heading towards them. The two pairs of shoes were going to secure the foyer, probably by the main doors. It wouldn't be long now before everything kicked off, and the Japanese would really have something to complain about. Whatever these two BG did, we had them covered. If they stayed inside, it was Nightmare's and Carpenter's job to take them on once they'd sorted out the BG immediately around Val. Outside, it was down to the other three. We all waited, and I sweated as people around me laughed, hit keypads, and talked between mouthfuls of alcohol. There was a ping from the far right lift. Another two pairs of black patent leather shoes, dress suit trousers, complete with silk stripe under black overcoats. They stepped out on either side of a light grey cashmere coat and the smartest trousers of all, followed by a pair of very long, slim, well-toned black stockinged calves, topped off with the world's most luxuriant mink. Val's slapper, keeping him warm on those long, lonely nights away from his family. I had to be careful. There was always the possibility of someone you overlook during surveillance. The one who looks like the brother-in-law or secretary. Then, when you hit the target, they can prove very dangerous indeed. But not this one. She was definitely not part of the BG setup. They had turned right out of the lift without hesitating. I stood up slowly, waiting for my cue. I caught Carpenter's scary, dancing eyes as he and Nightmare crossed the doorway, moving right to left, matching the purposeful strides of the BG. We'd rehearsed what was supposed to happen next so many times. It had to work, and there was no stopping this now. I turned left out of the door and fell in behind them as they drew their suppressed weapons. About 5 meters ahead of us, the backs and very wide shoulders of the BG pair flanked Val and the slapper as they moved towards the Japanese-filled foyer. We needed to close in on them fast, while they were still in the confines of the corridor. Once out in the foyer, the rest of Val's team would be able to see what was about to happen before the 4x4s could get into position. 3 more meters before we were on top of them. There was another ping, then a bright light from a lift interior as the doors opened, and a middle-aged couple began to step out between us and the target. I moved to push them back. This was a contingency I had rehearsed with them many times. As I did so, Carpenter's right hand came up. Without taking his eyes off Val, he fired 3 or 4 suppressed rounds into the couple as he passed. I could hear the top slide on his weapon working back and forth inches from my face, and the dull thud of the rounds exiting the barrel. Shit. Her scream had turned the job noisy, and we hadn't even taken out the BG. The couple fell back into the lift, the woman taking all the rounds. Her white silk blouse red with blood. Fuck this guy. Slotting players was one thing, but real people meant big trouble. The two BG turned and started to draw down their weapons, but Carpenter and Nightmare had closed the gap and gave them both 2 rounds in the head from less than a foot away. They dropped without a sound. Nobody in the vicinity had noticed anything yet. They were too busy doing their own stuff, but they soon would. As the BG dropped, Carpenter should have moved on, but he continued firing down at the bodies. The BG were dead. He was wasting time. Behind me, the man in the lift cried out as he cradled his dying wife. I saw Carpenter's glazed eyes. He was high on whatever it was that he used to get through the long winters. Sergei would be busy tonight if we stayed alive and he stuck to his promise. Fuck it. I'd kill this maniac myself before this got out of control. Keeping my eyes fixed on Carpenter's head as he fired yet another round into the BG, I shoved my right hand between my jacket and shirt towards my 88, my left palm pointing towards him, arm bent and ready to receive the weapon that would soon be in my grip. The screams from the lift were now muffled. I wasn't aware of anything else as I concentrated solely on Carpenter's head as he turned to fire into the other body on the floor. My fingers scraped against the body armor as I leaned forwards slightly from the hip and pushed my coat and jacket back as aggressively as I could. The weight of the metal sockets helped me to expose my weapon for the second I needed. Pushing the web of my right hand firmly down into the 88's pistol grip, I closed my lower three fingers and thumb around it as firmly as possible. Drawing the weapon, I started to insert my glove-free index finger into the trigger guard, making sure I could feel the steel of the trigger on the first pad. I pulled down on the safety catch with my thumb just before Carpenter fired his next round. There was the glint of brass as the working parts ejected the spent casing between us. As he tried to fire again, I could see the top slide being held back by the locking lever. He had run out of rounds. Jamming the 88 into my left hand, I punched forward and raised the weapon up in between my focus on his head, waiting for that nanosecond before the 88 came into view and I acquired the sight picture. Real life burst into my eardrums once again. It was nightmare, shouting into his Motorola at the 4x4s to move in on the mercs as he gripped Carpenter's arm, dragging him towards the foyer. I was now no more than 2 steps from Val. He was still looking at the bodies on the floor, taking in what he had just seen over the last 10 seconds. He went into survival mode, spinning round and looking back towards the restaurant, thinking that he could make his escape. We had eye to eye. He knew I was coming for him, and he knew it was too late to do much about it. Everything went into slow motion as I focused completely on his neck. It was pointless paying attention to anything else around me. There was fuck all I could do about it. I was now only 1 step away. He was expecting to get shot, and stood there waiting, accepting. There was nothing he could do. He must have known this would happen one day. I put the crook of my left arm around his neck, still moving forward so it jammed tight against his throat. He staggered backwards as I took another step, forcing his face upwards. I heard him gag. He was only 5'7", so quite easy to get a grip of. If it had been his companion, I might have had to get on the balls of my feet. The slapper in the mink didn't react at all. I expected her to scream, but she just stood off to one side, back to the wall, and watched. With the pistol in my right hand and still moving, I pushed my right arm behind his neck to complete the headlock, like a wrestler trying to get a better hold of his opponent. At once, he started fighting for oxygen. There was no way he wasn't coming with me. There was no need to check in for weapons. He didn't need one tonight. He was a businessman on his way to the theater. I continued on towards the foyer. Val didn't like what I was doing to him. His back arched to try to take the weight of his body off his neck. I was in a semi-crouched position so I could carry his weight. I could feel the body armor he was wearing, disguised as a waistcoat. I concentrated on looking where we were going, towards the Russians shouting in the foyer and the suddenly silent Japanese. Nothing else mattered. 4 or 5 more seconds had elapsed, and the people inside the hotel could not only see what had happened, but had had time for it to sink in. It takes a while for a brain not used to processing this sort of information to say, "Yep, that's right. There are 2 dead men on the floor and others with submachine guns shouting and running around the foyer." Then, once one person starts becoming hysterical, they all do. I turned into the foyer, heading for the exit. Nightmare came into view by the main doors, doing his stuff to one of the BG, shouting and screaming in Russian and kicking his hands away from his body. I was 20-odd meters away from them. The Japanese followed everyone else's example, running for cover and hiding behind the sofas, dragging their loved ones with them. That was great. The more they flapped, the less they saw. A 2-tone alarm started to drown out the screams, and I moved as fast as I could. Nightmare was there, checking my back as he covered the BG. Gripping tight, I pulled Bal along. He snorted like a horse, fighting for breath. Through the windows, the blaze of headlights from the three Mercs lit Sergei's 4x4, which had the tailgate open, waiting for me and Bal. Beyond the Mercs' roofs, I could see Reggie and Ronnie, AK butts unfolded and in the shoulder, muzzles pointing at the ground. Bal's three drivers had already been dragged out of their seats and were face down on the tarmac. Carpenter was to the left of the convoy. He, too, had his weapon pointing down. He must have been covering the other BG. All three were blowing out steam like kettles. Sergei would be in the wagon, waiting for me to get out of this lunatic asylum. With 10 meters to go, World War III broke out. I heard a series of short bursts from a 9mm, the muzzle flashes bouncing off the windows like flashbulbs. It was Carpenter, giving the BG the best part of a mag. Then the shots were drowned out by the screaming in the foyer. It was like the sinking of the Titanic. I couldn't believe it. More muzzle flashes lit up the darkness outside, the heavier 7.62 reports from Reggie and Ronnie echoing through the building. The drivers must have gone for their weapons, thinking they were next. Nightmare was frozen to the spot, shaking with fear as he stood over the last BG. He stared at me, waiting for direction. I flicked a look at the BG. His eyes were switched on and waiting for a chance to get away from this gang fuck. There was nothing I could do for Nightmare. It was starting to flap big time. He would have to sort it out himself. There was no way I was going out the front door with a firefight in progress, especially as I didn't know the result. Turning back towards the corridor, I moved Val as quickly as I could, nearly falling over the concierge and a bellboy, who were down on the floor in the open, too paralyzed with fear to move. I got back to the corner of the corridor. The man was still sobbing over his wife in the lift. Her legs, in flesh-colored tights and sensible shoes, protruded into the corridor as the doors opened and closed against them. The slapper was still there, well in control of herself. She just stood, watching, not even bothering to wipe the dropped BG's blood and membrane off her face. There was more hysteria as rounds starred the safety glass around the entrance. The BG had obviously seized his chance and got to his feet, firing as he went for freedom. Nightmare took the burst into his unprotected trunk and crumpled on top of two Japanese tourists who stayed where they were, too shocked to move. The BG started towards me, mini Uzi in his right hand, its strap over his shoulder. What was he going to do? He couldn't open up on me without hitting his boss. Turning Bal round to face his BG and protect me, I lifted my .88. I wasn't going to do much against his body armor, even if I could hit a moving target at 15 meters one-handed with a pistol. I had to wait until he was nearer. I fired at him from about 10 meters and kept on firing, aiming below center mass. It was pointless aiming at his head at that range. I'd emptied at least half of the 20-round mag, not knowing whether it was going to drop him or not, when I heard him scream and he went down, his legs buckling. I didn't care where I'd hit him, just that I had. Dragging Val, I passed the reception, trying to avoid the video camera, and headed towards the shop. I was going it alone now, leaving the contact outside to sort itself out. The money was wrapped in my arms, and I wasn't about to give it up. I turned right, down a wide corridor, heading for the rear car park door. I knew where I needed to go. Time in reconnaissance is seldom wasted. Passing the conference rooms and business center, I pulled Val along the thick piled carpet, both of us finding it difficult to breathe. Me from fear and physical exertion, him from strangulation. It was pointless checking behind me. I'd soon know if there was a drama. I'd get shot at. People cowered in doorways as they saw us coming. That suited me fine. Reaching the bottom of the corridor, I climbed 4 steps, then turned left and climbed 10 more. The inner car park door was held open by a fire extinguisher. I hit the crossbar of the second and burst out onto the red asphalt at the rear of the building. The cold took my breath away. I could hear the odd shout from one or two locals crazy enough to come out of their apartments to see what all the fuss was about. My breath was like a racehorse's on a winter gallop. I could hear Val moan. His nostrils were working overtime. There was a stretch of 20 meters or so to the road. All around me, steam escaped from pipes and ventilation shafts, and generators hummed like ship's engines. If I got one of the service vehicles, I'd turn left, downhill to the main, where the drone of traffic was coming from. After about 10 meters, I could see the car park and loading bays. The only vehicle in sight was a small Hilux van. Fuck it. That would have to do. With the security lights exposing me to the spectators at their windows in the apartments across the street, I tried the door. It was locked. There were no passing vehicles to lift. The roadworks just up the hill had seen to that. There was no choice but to drag Val up the concrete stairs and onto the loading bay. Inside was what looked like a minicab office, with a desk, phone and paperwork in piles. A woman in her mid-20s was standing talking hysterically in Finnish on the phone, her left hand waving in the air as if beating off a swarm of wasps. At first, she didn't recognize what was in front of her, until I shouted and pointed the 88. "The keys! Give me the vehicle keys, now!" She knew what I was saying. She dropped the phone, the other end still talking, and pointed at the desk. I grabbed them and ran back down the stairs to the van. Val clenching his teeth as he took the pain in his neck. It still wasn't worth checking around me. I knew I was being watched, and worrying about it wasn't going to make it stop. By now, the woman in the minicab office would be back on the phone, telling the world anyway. I ripped off the cardboard that was keeping the windscreen ice-free and opened the passenger door using my left hand. My right was on the weapon, and I needed to keep the exposed trigger finger from making any contact. I might need to move my arse, but not at the expense of leaving prints. "Get in! Get in!" He might not speak English, but with my pistol stuck into his neck, Val got the drift. Once I'd finished kicking him in, I climbed over on top of him, keeping the barrel of the pistol into his neck as I moved into the driver's seat and put the key in the ignition. Firing the engine, I threw it into gear. The tires pounded the cobblestones as I drove downhill to the main, the demister on full. I could see the streetlights ahead, with the traffic cutting across from both directions. I got level with the hotel drive. The Nissan was missing. Maybe Sergei had got away. All the other vehicles were still there. Christmas lights had fallen off the trees and lay across the tarmac, amongst the scattering of empty brass cases. Bodies were strewn all over the ground. I couldn't tell who was who from this distance, though one of them had to be Reggie or Ronnie because the whole area was covered by a thin blanket of mist. One of their CS canisters must have got hit and was still spewing its contents into the wind. One of the drivers had nearly got away. His suited body was slumped by one of the small decorative trees just before the exit. Steam rose from the blood oozing from his gunshot wounds. It looked as if their armor wasn't designed to take AP rounds either. I passed by, suddenly thinking about the couple in the lift. Then, stopping at the junction with the main drag, I focused on what to do next. I turned right and merged with the traffic. Chapter 3. Flashing blue lights raced towards me as I headed in the direction of the city center, nearly blinding me as they screamed past. At the second option, I turned right, up the road where Sergei and I had waited in the Nissan. The 88 was in my right hand, still rammed into Val's neck, forcing me to change gear with my left and hold the wheel in position with my knees. The target was amazingly compliant. In fact, unless I was reading it wrong, his body language seemed to be saying, "No sweat. I'll just wait and see what happens next." The DOP was about 10 minutes away, and should have marked the end of Phase 1 and the beginning of Phase 2, the change of vehicles and a move to the truck service station, from where we would all RV before moving over the border into Russia. Plan B was in action now. In the event of a gangfuck, We'd each make our own way back to the lakeside house where we'd been based for the last 2 weeks and wait for 24 hours. I was feeling very vulnerable and exposed without Sergei. I might have the money curled up in the footwell, but without help there was no way I was going to get it over the border. Sergei was the only one squared away with the world's most corrupt border guards, and he had been too switched on to tell anyone else how it was organized. I just knew that we were going in a truck adapted to conceal us all under the floor like IIs, illegal immigrants, which Sergei would drive. That was his insurance policy, and the reason I'd given him the least dangerous job on the operation. The road started to bend right, heading out of the city. I travelled this route to the DOP both physically and in my head tens of times. It went through residential areas with snow piled neatly at the sides of the wet roads, street lighting and Christmas decorations reflecting off the gleaming cobblestones. From all around me came the sound of sirens, jolting me out of my pissed-off-with-all-Russians mode. Blue lights flashed across a junction ahead of me. I took the next right, anything to get off the road and out of sight. I'd turned into a driveway leading to the rear of an apartment block. There was no lighting back there as I drove over to the far side and stopped under a covered parking space. Keeping the engine running, I sat with the weapon stuck in Val's neck as sirens screamed from all sides. Now what? No way was I going on foot. If spotted, the only way to escape would be to leave him. That wasn't an option. The money stayed with me. Fuck it. There was nothing I could do but brass it out. The longer I stayed there, the more police would be in the area looking for the van. What was more, they'd have time to throw cordons around the city before we got out. I needed to get to the DOP as soon as possible and detach myself from the hotel roadshow. Back on the road, I put my foot down. It was dodgy, but sometimes it's best not to think too much. 4 more minutes and I was level with the chain-link fence of the car park. Over to my right, towards the hotel, a low-flying helicopter lit up the sky with its night sun. The beam bounced around, searching the park and frozen lake on the other side of the main drag from the